Welcome to the Senate Education and General Government Committee.
Thank you.
We'll start today with a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 72. Morgan Allen, Dana Richardson, would you read the summary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 72 removes education service districts from the definition of school districts under the general provisions for special education services statutes. Declares emergency, excuse me, it would take effect upon passage. We also have dash one amendments before us that permits the parent of a child with a disability to revoke consent for an initial evaluation, a reevaluation, provision of special education related services, or placement in a special education program.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and joining me today is Ty Manieri, who's a legal specialist in our Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. And don't let the bill summary scare you. We're not trying to limit special education services through ESDs. We're actually here because Senate Bill 72 is one of my infamous technical cleanup bills to bring Oregon statute in compliance with new federal law and regulations related to special education. So there's really two parts to it. The original bill as drafted is a technical update to the statute to clarify that school districts, not ESDs, are responsible for meeting the special education needs of students in their school district. So this has nothing to do with the contracts for special education service that ESDs enter into with school districts. But as you all know, the federal law places that responsibility with the school district, and in a couple of places in Oregon statute around special education law, there's still the ESD is still included in that definition. So we need to just pull that out to clean that up and make that very clear. The dash one amendment is actually needed. The previous presidential administration, as many presidential administrations do on the way out the door, passed some of those late-night rule changes. And on December 31st, 2008, the U.S. Department of Education made some rule changes to the IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities Education Act. The major change that was made on the 31st of December was that parents were allowed to unilaterally remove students from special education programs and services, and they were not previously allowed to do that. You could only exit special education if you aged out, you graduated, or there was some reevaluation later on in your schooling, and it was determined that you no longer needed special education services. So now we have a new part of the federal IDEA regulations say that parents can pull those kids out unilaterally. So the dash one amendment reflects this change. And as you know, it's necessary for us to revise Oregon statute because we have to, part of the some of the strings with IDEA and the funding and all that stuff is that Oregon law has to be in compliance with the federal regulations. And then there's just a few other technical cleanups in there in my testimony. There's some old language about pre-placement evaluation and placed in a program providing education and special and related services, and we sort of put in the modern terminology or the more updated terminology, initial evaluation and initial provision of special education and related services. So that's really, Mr. Chair, a very long-winded way of saying that Senate Bill 72 and the Dash 1 Amendment is necessary to ensure that Oregon is in compliance with federal special education regulations related to IDEA. So we urge the committee passage, and Ty and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan, do we have any idea at this point in time when the feds are going to fully fund IDEA?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I think we all dream of that day. But I would say that, you know, with the federal stimulus package, we are seeing some more funding related to both Title I and IDEA, and I think there's a lot of hope that the current administration and the new Secretary of Education are going to take a hard look at that. And I know there's a lot of people at the federal level putting pressure on them to do that. But I think, just like everyone else, it's sort of a wait and see. But we can dream, I think, hopefully.
Ms. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Unfortunately, the stimulus has cliffs at the back end, like all stimulus does. So hopefully there can be movement at the federal level to continue it.
Other questions for the Department of Education?
We don't have a fiscal yet. Either.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, should we have submitted a fiscal. There's no fiscal to the agency, so no surprises there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware that the fiscal analyst on this piece has been asked by her her supervisor essentially to go back and ask a few more questions on this, and that's why we don't have a statement at this
okay.
time.
Well, we can adopt the dash one and set this aside.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 72.
Senator Morris moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 72. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we might have that by 5 o'clock, we might not. If we don't, we'll. Okay, we're best to get it out later this week.
Thank you.
Close public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 72 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 123.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 123 was brought to you by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and it relates to the communication between the Department of Human Services with regard to child abuse reports and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. There is a dash one amendment that specifies with regard to these child abuse records. They would be provided to TSPC for investigations involving any child or student in grade 12 or below. So a clarifying bit of language in the dash ones. We do have all of the necessary paperwork on this bill as well as the fiscal impact statement.
Good afternoon, Chair Hobbs, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I gave you written testimony. We brought this bill to you because the commission had struggled over years to obtain these reports when we were involved in investigations that we knew there was a possibility of child abuse. And in the last 7 years, we've obtained two, one directly from the agency and another one through a caregiver. The statute appears to allow them to give us the report, but I think in exercising an abundance of caution, we've had difficulty getting them. We negotiated the amendments with DHS, and in fact, we formed a nice new relationship with them, and we're all happy with that. But the thing the bill gives that DHS didn't have before is language that ensures that we will keep those records confidential, which is something that they wouldn't have had if we hadn't asked for this legislation. And finally, I wanted to just comment on the changes on page 3. Last time I was testifying in front of you, we had a bill with a lot of changes. Those are housekeeping bills that legislative council suggested to clean up some of our existing statutes. So in lieu of the language removed on page 3, lines 14 and 15, they have rewritten the new paragraphs to make the application more clear. It doesn't change its legal meaning.
Thank you. There was under what circumstances do you envision asking or demanding from DHS these records, or perhaps you could give us one of those hypotheticals?
Whenever there's been an allegation that the educator has been reported for child abuse, we like to get a copy of the report in terms of the finding. If, as you know, if it rises to criminal behavior, then it goes into law enforcement, and then we're able to obtain police reports and that sort of thing. If law enforcement doesn't take it, then DHS will conduct an investigation, and they will make a finding. And these can be very helpful, actually, when it involves either the educator's child or conduct with a student. So in the time that I have been here, we have requested about a half a dozen to eight times, but they've been very serious cases.
And the problem is sometimes they give them to you, sometimes they don't? Or
one time they've given them to us. The other time we got it from a grandmother.
Questions, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please explain sort of logistically how this is going to work? Are you going to request the records from DHS, or is DHS going to provide them to you?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, we will request them.
And how will it be brought? Follow up, please, Mr. Chair. How will it be brought to your attention that there is this type of report filed with DHS?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, generally we learn this through the course of our investigation. It's quite possible there would be reports we wouldn't be aware of, but if there is any accusation of abuse or suspicion of abuse with a child, that would be, we would be asking if there had been a report.
Thank you.
And if you get this report and it's an accusation, how does that play into, is that just part of your sort of system of deciding what to do?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, you know, that's a great question because from that point on it becomes very complex. We would be keeping it confidential, and we learned just recently through a hearing where we had one of these reports that it really involves some intricate orchestration and coordination with DHS in order to be able to use any of this as evidence. So, but we did work that out, too, very collaboratively when we did have the one report. So it's just additional evidence when you may not have a victim testifying or something like that. It would prevent us from talking to children because we couldn't obtain the evidence otherwise. I think it actually protects children in a lot of ways. It could also vindicate the educator. In other words, if the finding was no finding and they couldn't find any evidence, it can go in favor of the other way. So,
further questions of Ms. Chamberlain? Anyone else signed up to testify or would like to testify in this case? Thank you.
I'd say since Mickey's sitting very quietly in the back that he's okay.
I think we want to do this.
Okay. Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
Not yet.
Public hearing.
I'm going to close a special a public hearing on Senate Bill 123 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 123.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 123.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 123. Any discussion? If not, is there an objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 123 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 123 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Bonamici, we're back over to you.
Thank you.
Would you like to carry this bill?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. We are going to open up a public hearing now on two bills simultaneously. If I can find my program. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 441 and Senate Bill 501. This is a bill that we've heard, Senate Bill 501, already on financial literacy. Senator Metzger has requested to change it because of the relating clause. It will replace Senate Bill 441, the amendment that is. And so we're going to hold a public hearing on both of these at the same time. But for purposes of us moving forward, this will be Senate Bill 441. Senator Morris, would you like to explain your...
We get goofed up. Method. We get goofed up all the time here.
Senator Metzger, would you like to explain?
I'd be happy to fill in for you.
We get mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this time I'll go up front, though.
Okay.
I can tell them apart.
Yeah.
Frank's taller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to talk about a revision to Senate Bill 441. As you recall, in the hearing that we had on Senate Bill 501 and talking about financial literacy and why it's important for our students. A number of points were brought up that were critical to being able to actually make a positive impact, and I think I will just summarize the committee hearing that, yes, this is very important, but we don't think this actually gets to what we're trying to do. And so working with the Department of Education in developing a way to actually get to the testimony that we heard why this is absolutely critical, and that we have not been doing a very good job of it. So I think the overall goal here is a number of things, that financial skills can and should be incorporated into current curriculum using real-life examples. They should graduate from high school with a comprehensive understanding of earning, spending, saving, investing money. And Civics and Financial Task Force made recommendations incorporated in the bills. Senate Bill 441, as you said, Mr. Chair, is a gut and stuff of elements of Senate Bill 501. It is aimed to include financial skills into current high school curriculum. The problems with Senate Bill 501 as originally drafted was the relating to clause based on where we were trying to go, and number two, it didn't have any credit associated with the required skills. We also heard in testimony that in our goal of making this an essential skill, which would lead to an assessment for graduation, that the essential skills, as defined by the Board of Education, are not in statute, and then this would create a problem putting one in statute where the others were not. So the amendment that we have to Senate Bill 441 is designed to address those concerns. It adds finances into the definition of social sciences. It adds a half credit of personal finances into the current social science credit requirement for high school diploma, and I think that's very important. We're not adding another credit to the high school diploma that has requirements that have recently been set by the Board of Education. It's incorporated into this. But a couple of things I want to make very clear. It doesn't necessarily mean, nor would I anticipate as curriculum was developed for this, that it's always, it just means the social science teacher part of this. Because we talked about math and a number of different expertise, teachers with expertise can contribute to this half course credit within social sciences. I would envision that both, you know, the math instructors as well as social science instructors would be involved in helping to develop the credit for this half, but it would be at least considered as part of the three social sciences part. But sometimes we get into this idea that, well, if it's a social science credit, then it must mean just always the social science teachers are involved, and that is not necessarily the case. But it puts this way, so we're not adding additional credits. It just talks about how we focus this curriculum. But by doing that, it then moves it to one of the key goals of the task force, which is a requirement for graduation, is to show a level of expertise in financial literacy. It includes the following into the definition of financial curriculum: personal financial management skills, basic principles associated with earning, spending, and investing money. And I want to give you a couple of excerpts from the Financial Education Task Force. To include personal finance within the standard requirements to give a consistent statewide definition of what students should know and be able to do. And two, the State Board of Education should include financial literacy as an essential skill, and I told you the difficulty with that approach, but the end result was, and require that students show proficiency in an Oregon diploma. So this gets us to that end, but through a different approach. Now, I will tell you, Mr. Chair and members, that I am confident that the Board of Education and all their education folks will find reasons to say this is wonderful, but they still don't want to do it. After all these years, I know how that works. And while there's no fiscal attached to this, I've heard rumors that all of a sudden there's going to be a big fiscal, which always happens when people don't like things. But I would caution the committee that that's baloney. The State Board has adopted these going forward. Part of the statute, as you know and you can read, is that they have to work on devising curriculum to implement the credits that are required, and so they're doing this anyway, and this is going to be part of their ongoing job, and we're telling them to be specific about this as they are with anything else, but this is not a new assignment. This will be part of what they have to do anyway. The second part of it, though, is that if you'll notice, the implementation date for the graduation requirement is not until 2014. So we did take that into consideration of the existing track for students. So that's 5 years. And Mr. Chair and members, as we've talked about things that are much higher hurdles to reach, for example, the kindergarten issue that is so close to you, Mr. Chair, and all of us, that when you look at the 5 years to do this as compared to that, and if we can do that, we can certainly make sure that in the 5 years the curriculum is developed to focus in on financial education. I will conclude by saying that, as we all know, the easiest thing to defend is the status quo. And in the 6 years since I've been involved with this issue, the status quo has prevailed. And we're in a financial hurt in this country, and we have not made any significant progress, clearly, with students, as was pointed out in the task force, is understanding the importance of our financial system, and it's time that we do something about it. So I have worked very hard with my staff, and I give them a lot of credit for this, to work at addressing the legitimate issues that were brought before this committee, but I think it's time to move forward and set in place a mechanism for focusing on making sure that the students of Oregon are going to be equipped to deal with the financial issues of adulthood that are so key to our economy and the successful citizenry. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions, I'm happy to take those or others that will come after.
Questions of Senator Metzger?
Thank you.
Pam Levitt. I'm sorry. I have Ben Westland, who's here. And he's in the front row. So he might as well. It says here you're the Oregon State Treasurer.
That's why I sit in the front row, Mr. Chair. The for the record, Ben Westland, Oregon State Treasurer. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, suffice it to say I could speak for much longer on this vitally important subject than the committee has tolerance for. So in addition to saying maybe the most important thing, good amendment should be adopted, let me just briefly say that, you know, up to and including 1997, Oregon required a half credit of personal finance for students to graduate from high school. Even that meager requirement no longer exists. And obviously, as we all know and are currently seeing the result of, you know, since then, the financial world has gotten not just more complex, but much more complex. The need for financial literacy is now not just more important, but crucial. You know, today, consumers, including us, we've all seen this. We're offered a vast array of products, services that providers choose from to meet, you know, their financial needs and provide financial, quote, services to us. While more options are certainly a good thing, people need to know and have the skills to make the right choices regarding the ever-complex choices they are provided. Not all choices may be the right one. Introductory rate offers from credit card companies sound great until you read the really fine print. And there are, of course, payday lenders, you know, penalty rates, countless car insurance options that have less than adequate coverage, countless health insurance options that sound good as a price, you know, without the proper benefits, you know, or a complex set of copays and deductibles. There are basic skills that we need to learn to function. Financial literacy is almost as important as literacy. You got to be literate to be able to learn financial literacy, but they go hand in hand in creating a quality life that allows individuals in this increasingly complex financial world to make the right financial choices for themselves and their families. Mr. Chair, I could go on and on and on. This is a passion of mine, as I know it is for yours and Senator Metzger's, probably most members of the committee. In simplest terms, this is not just the right thing to do. This is the right thing to do for every Oregonian. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Treasurer Westland? Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it.
Thank you so very much, sir.
Pam Leavitt and her team, Carolyn Roy and Melody Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Leavitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Carlin Roy with me from OSU Federal Credit Union and I testified on Senate Bill 501 in March, provided you with extensive testimony on the credit union work in the area of financial education. I have been representing the credit unions for 15 years, and at least half of that I've been pushing financial literacy legislation, including last session in 2007 when I helped write and create the Financial Education and Civics Task Force legislation that you'll hear from the report today. I'm not going to go over our testimony again. You should have it in your Senate Bill 501 information, but I do want to say that we want financial literacy to move forward in this state. We certainly support the task force recommendations, which ask the Department of Education to make it an essential skill. We support Senator Metzger's amendments to add a half a credit. We are looking at moving this issue forward in the state. We are in the forefront of seeing the problems with our youth and not being taught financial literacy. I will just conclude by saying that I gave you a copy of a national report card on financial personal finance. And on page 3, it talks about personal finance in each of our states. And I'll just read briefly. The number of states with content standards for personal finance was 40 in 2007, an increase of 19 from 1998. The number of states requiring implementation of content standards is 28, up 14 states from 1998. The number of states requiring a course to be offered is 9, and which is an increase of 9 from 1998. The number of states requiring a course to be taken for graduation is currently 7, up from 6 in 1998. And the number of states requiring testing is 9, an increase of 8 from 1998. This issue is going around the country. State legislatures all over the nation are talking about financial literacy, and we certainly think it's time. We as credit unions, I want to conclude by saying we understand the budget constraints of this state and know that a fiscal on this kind of a bill is not a good thing at this point in time. We're willing to work with all interested parties, but again, we want to move the issue of financial literacy forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carlin Roy. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at OSU Federal Credit Union in Corvallis, Oregon. As Pam stated, I provided written and verbal testimony over a month ago when we had the hearing on this. And I am here primarily to answer any questions you may have on behalf of credit unions, especially those of us that are teaching financial education within our schools at our own expense. I also would like to add that it's very important to support this. As a mother of two boys who graduated from a public school system within the state of Oregon within this decade, I can tell you that they did not have any financial education at all within their curriculum. At Corvallis High School, it is an elective, and the only way they know anything about money is because their mother pounded it into their heads. Many, many children will benefit by learning the importance of financial literacy early in their lives and having it reinforced. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Melody Thompson, and I'm the Executive Director of Financial Beginnings. We're a nonprofit that goes into schools to teach personal finance. I'm also the chair of the Oregon Jumpstart Coalition, which is an organization that promotes financial literacy, and I'm a member of the Civics and Finance Education Task Force. I'm also here primarily to help and answer any questions, but would like to just kind of share, you know, my thoughts on this and the need for financial literacy in schools. You know, we work with students throughout the entire state. This year we'll be serving over 3,000 students, and I can tell you that the students want this information, and we really do need to require it. You know, hearing about classes being electives, unfortunately the people that really need the information are not the ones that are going to go take the elective. So we want to make sure that all of these students are able to leave school with this essential information. Looking at the economy right now, it's quite obvious that the need for financial literacy is imperative. So please let me know if you have any questions I can help answer.
Questions of this panel? Susan Apravena. Some of you on the committee might remember Susan, who was on the Financial Education Task Force, who presented her report to the Interim Education Committee in October?
October 27th,
yeah.
2008. Good afternoon. My name is Susan Abravanel, and I'm here today as the chair of the much-talked-about Civics and Financial Education Task Force that was created by this body. And I am actually having distributed a copy of that report that we presented because I do want to point out a number of pieces in the interpretation of that report as we look at this legislation today. For the record, I am against Senate Bill 441 with specific reference to its provision on page 7, section 6, number 2D, which requires the half credit of financial literacy. I will tell you that the task force is as passionate in advocating for financial literacy in our schools as any of the prior speakers have been. So on that, we stand united. What we do not see eye to eye on is the method in which that is going to happen. And we were very specific in the recommendations in the task force. Now that these have been distributed, I would like to turn your attention to the recommendations on page 23 and to look specifically to the section entitled Instruction. And under that category, that recognize that financial education is a basic component of K-12 education. From that, we determined that we would have a strategy of embedding it in K-12, in other words, all the way through, not just in high school, that we would want it integrated with other content areas and provide adequate instructional time. Amongst the other recommendations throughout this document is significant professional development for teachers who are going to be presenting this material, both in preparing them to teach the material initially and in upgrading their qualifications as time proceeds. I do want to point out that one of my major concerns, in addition to the fact that by reducing this to a half credit that is taught in high school, is that with our new credit by proficiency opportunity, this gives a student the opportunity to essentially test out of or waive any kind of in-school financial literacy education. With the method that we are suggesting, which is as an essential skill, as one of the essential skills, we are anticipating that financial literacy would be taught K-12. It would be embedded all the way through. And the reason why we chose that particular methodology is that the task force was really asked to look at two things. The first thing we were asked to look at is the scan of where are we in this state in financial literacy? What is the current status? What is the current situation? And the second thing we were asked to do was to look at some research. What are the national best practices that we can bring to this state? National best practices showed us very clearly that having a single course in a high school, in the high school years is not sufficient, that financial literacy needs to be taught earlier and it needs to be reinforced along the way. And so for that reason, we looked to the essential skill. We were not uncomfortable with the 2014 date, with the recognition that this is that there is a need to have this K-12 approach, and we're going to need to get to 2014 with implementation all along the way of introducing financial literacy in the earlier grades. My other concern about this is that if we have one half credit that, as is stated in Senate Bill 441, taken out of the three credits that are now reserved for social studies, this bill actually now puts, instead of the current four content areas of civics, history, geography, and economics into those three credits, we now have six credits, according to this bill, in that. Adding in the I'm sorry, Oregon Studies, and then actually you're reducing it and basically saying, no, you really have five credits that are going to be in the or five content areas in the 2.5 credits because you've sliced out 1/2 credit now to be dedicated to financial literacy. And it is our concern that this is not enough. It's not sufficient for the remaining social studies areas. And even in the prior era when we did have a required half credit, which, by the way, the legislature removed. At that time, we had 3.5 credits that we were looking at, and so it was reduced down to 3. So I guess I kind of said what I need to say, and I'm here to answer any questions, and I will do so on behalf of the task force, taking the prerogative of being its chair.
Susan, you your research showed that this is better embedded in K-12 than in the high school years.
Yes.
And you put that in your report, and that report then was forwarded to the state board?
It was the recommendation of actually the Senate Education Committee on October 27th that we then go over and do our presentation to the state board. We did that towards the middle of January. And I believe it was January 16th, and the state board is now currently considering moving forward on their own on this specific recommendation. I believe they're actually going to be discussing it for a third time tomorrow. They discussed it first on January 16th, then at a subsequent meeting, and for a third time it's on their docket in their meetings tomorrow and Friday.
Okay. Questions of Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, you mentioned that the half credit was removed by the legislature at one point in time. When you were chairing the task force, did you talk about why that happened? Did you get any history behind that?
Yes, it's my understanding that it was removed because at the time there was some concern that there was not enough emphasis, there weren't enough credits to go around, and there was only, I think, one credit in science that was required at the time. So there was a desire to cut back a little bit on the social sciences in order to beef up the credits available for science.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up? Thank you. I'm hoping for some clarification here because I've the bill that created the task force is a bill that I co-sponsored and worked on in the 2007 session. So thank you for being here. Can you clarify, is this particular approach of having a half credit for finances, is that something the task force specifically discussed?
Yes, we specifically discussed it quite at length, and that was when we started looking at best practices and determined that for essentially two reasons, because it didn't seem to produce the outcomes that we were looking for, and secondly, because of with a required half credit, most of our school districts are not in large district communities, and so you will find the financial literacy teacher who is really not a dedicated financial literacy teacher, but someone who happens to be the available a teacher who needs another another half credit to complete an FTE. So it is not someone who is well trained. Often it is someone who just needs to fill that requirement out, and that was part of our concern as to why the quality of the teaching of financial literacy was very quite varied across the state, quite diverse.
Thank you.
Other questions, Senator Metzger?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Susan. A couple of things, and I appreciate your comment about the essential skill, and I want to make sure that that we understand if the previous discussion we had on that is that that's the right approach, but we can't do that because it's not into statute. And so the skills are not into statute. And that by putting this as an essential skill, it would trump all the other essential skills. And so, therefore, the idea of the essential skill was that it would lead to a graduation requirement and assessment for that. And so what this actually does is, since we can't do it that way, by making a graduation requirement, it is more likely we'll then have to become an essential skill adopted by the boards, and kind of a reverse process on that. The other thing is, though, and I appreciate your comment because I think you gave a pretty good history of the reason why the particular credit was then. And one of the things that we're hearing now is that, and hopefully this is accurate from the last 10 years, is that now an overwhelming number and increasingly number of our teachers are highly qualified, in other words, to actually teach what they're supposed to be teaching. And if that is accurate, then I would believe that the problems of the past would hopefully not be duplicated in the future, because as we get these things, and we've, I believe it was an over an 80% level that was presided, this committee are now highly qualified, that would move in that direction. And then the final thing, and your comment on this, is one of the things that we do that I've observed in education is kind of the silo mentality. You know, you have, as you mentioned, someone, they have to teach this or this, and if not, then someone fills it in. But I believe our education professionals are much more skilled at being able to develop curriculum that is delivered not necessarily by one teacher in one area. In other words, in teaching mathematics, part of this half credit requirement to be tested, I would imagine would be able and critical to be taught actually in the math setting to meet the math requirement, but also reinforce that skill as well as the social studies requirement. I guess my concern would be, and I'd like to have you comment on that, since we can't do the essential skill, if we can't move it as a requirement for graduation, which then forces the state board to act in more of a positive way as an essential skill, then we have the status quo, which I think we've all agreed is not appropriate. So I just would be interested in your comments on that, and again, thank you for all your work on the task force.
Can you clarify, you had a number of yes. questions in there. Can you clarify specifically what it is that you would like me to comment on?
Well, I just want to hear in terms of what you think, because my view is unless we take action going forward, there isn't going to be any action, and we'll be back doing this again, as I've noticed over the last 8 years, 2 years from now. And if because the essential skill that we had talked about and we had hoped doesn't work for our legislating abilities here. So it's just a matter of trying to convince the state board to do that, which is always wonderful, but so heretofore has not happened.
Okay. It was our, based on our scan, first of all, I want to go back a little bit and respond to your comment about highly qualified teachers and teachers who have significant background in what it is that they're teaching when it comes to financial literacy, and that is not what we found. And we specifically pulled in a panel of teachers to talk with as part of our research. We started with a planned out 5 meetings. We ended up with 8 meetings and a number of telephone calls. So we probably had 10 meetings in all. In other words, double the amount of work, which was not unexpected, because we really were dealing with 2 content areas. We were dealing with civics as well. I want to get to the specific comment about the essential skill, and that is that the Department of Education currently has 9 essential skills. Only 4 of them are now tested. It is our belief, it's our recommendation, that assessments be developed for this particular area. If it is assessed, it is taught. That is our recommendation. And when we spoke to the State Board of Education, we pointed out that although there are standards on the books, they are not being assessed currently. And so our recommendation was to have assessments for those standards. I also want to point out that those other 5 essential skills will be they are scheduled, as I understand it, to have assessments developed for them at some point. There is some delay at this point, but the goal is to have all 9 of them as essential skills, not just the first 4. So we are hoping that this would be the 10th one, and obviously it would be our hope that this would be the 5th to have its essential, that its assessments developed, not wait until it's the 10th. Does that help?
Well, no, I mean, I understand what I won't belabor the point, is that we attempted that approach and it didn't work. That's why we're here with the essential skill and putting that in. We can't direct the state board to make that. We can do that, as we attempted to do in 501, and the State Board of Education can comment on that, but that essentially would trump all the other skills, because there's a phase-in schedule, which would create a lot of problems, and obviously they're unwilling to do that. So I agree with you. I think the goal of the amendment here is, by making it a graduation requirement, to basically, force the State Board of Education then to have to make it an essential skill, because it's going to be a graduation requirement. I think that's basically the goal. of that, to get them to do what we obviously haven't been able to do through legislation, through 501.
Can I ask Senator Metzger a question?
Sure.
Would that violate some sort of protocol or something?
No, absolutely.
I'm a little bit confused because the recommendations that personal finance be an essential skill that came out of the task force, they haven't had time to implement them. They just were made. So you said it hasn't worked, but I think we heard that there's a meeting tomorrow or something. So I'm a little bit confused about whether there's been enough time for them to work. But you're under the impression that they haven't had a chance to do that.
I would just say, Senator Bonamici, I'm not saying anything won't happen, but I'll take kindergarten and other things as examples. I think it is important in what we do in terms of setting direction from the legislature to get things to happen. Things sometimes will happen anyway, and sometimes they don't. And especially if you have a department and you have other stakeholders who don't want something to go forward, sometimes it doesn't happen either.
Well, we're united in this goal, but just the methodology is different. Have you, not to put you in the hot seat, but would you be able to speculate on where things stand with this before the board?
Before the state board? Again, as I said, is my understanding that they are meeting tomorrow and they are raising this issue again tomorrow. I understand that they are looking at creating some kind of a body that will further study this, whether it's another task force. And it is my recommendation. I actually spoke with one of the state board members earlier today, recommending that actually this task force, since we've already done a year's worth of work on this, be reconvened to carry it forward, to come up with and to reinforce this recommendation. I really do feel that it's kind of ironic that we spent a year on a recommendation. We were applauded for our presentation in October and told that we had done superb work, and now all of that is being told, you know, all of that seems to be pushed aside while we go ahead and put together a half credit, which is precisely what we had decided against. So it just seems very odd to me, as someone who has been so intensely involved with this, that all of that work is pushed aside.
Okay, Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If only there were someone here from the Department of Education.
I think we
could. Morgan Allen, are you prepared to come up here and just answer some easy questions? Thank you. Not that you have any, you know, crystal ball into this, but what is the status of this before the board, and how likely is the board to act upon this task force recommendation?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I'm not up to speed on what they might be doing tomorrow. I know that the state board is very interested in this topic, but, you know, they're dealing with the reality of looking at rolling back some of the essential skills already on the books, like math. And so, you know, I would say fair to Midland is probably the likelihood that the board would actually add this as an essential skill. I could, you know, talk to the chair and see sort of what his thinking is on it and get back to the committee. But I think sort of given the other choices that they're faced with the essential skills that they've already developed and rolling those back and delaying implementation on at least the math essential skill, perhaps more depending on how bad things get. You know, I don't know where they're going to go, but it's probably not the direction that some members of the task force would like, would be my speculation, just to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger.
Sorry. Morgan, could you just share with the committee, because I did not a very good job of it, explaining why we had to move away from putting the essential skill in statute and how that impacted the progression of skills, just so there's a little better understanding than I was able to articulate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I don't know if I'll be able to do a much better job than you would, because you pretty much explained it the way I would. But essentially, the essential skills, you know, exist in I believe in rule, and you know, they're put forward by the board, and the current credit requirements for the various subjects were put into rule by the board as part of the Oregon diploma. And if you were to place an essential skill in statute, that one would essentially, for lack of a better description, take priority over everything else, would sort of perhaps, whether it would be civics or financial education, it would put it ahead of math and reading and some of the other essential skills that I think a lot of people would argue are more sort of the core functions or core essential skills that kids need to be learning as part of the diploma. So they would have to, that one would have to basically go to the front of the line, I think, for lack of a better description. So the other thing why I'm up here, I should probably clarify too, is as oftentimes happens around here, numbers start getting flung around about fiscal impacts and things like that, and the Legislative Fiscal Office has requested our agency to work up a fiscal on this, and our staff are working on this. I've heard some numbers being floated around like $1 million or more, and we don't have a specific number on this, but there is a fiscal impact to the department that people might be mixing up with a fiscal impact to school districts. As far as the department goes, probably the fiscal that we're looking at, there's really two different types of fiscals. The first would be the fiscal for staff to develop the new content standards related to the changes in diploma requirements. That, you know, involves bringing in panels of experts to make sure that the curriculums and professional development, all that stuff, is in place in time for when the bill goes into effect. Our staff estimated that's probably, you know, in the, you know, $50,000 to $80,000 range. That could be mitigated by moving it back, say, a school year, because what we're actually doing, the way the timelines work in the bill, is what it looks like we would need to do is we would need to accelerate that revision process for the standards and sort of move that to the front of the line from all the other standards work that we're doing. The other fiscal impact that would exist, and for the department, again, I'm just speaking for impacts on the department, is on page 5, section 4, where it talks about the department shall implement a valid statewide assessment system. So basically the assessments that we already do, our folks are going to have to, you know, change questions and revise assessments for the new standards, because you've changed it, you've sort of taken and created this new social science standard that we'd be required to assess. So, you know, that's probably, you know, a couple $100,000, you know, over time to do that. That would actually take several years to develop. So, you know, that would be done over, or, you know, probably maybe in time for the 13-14 school year or beyond. So there's a lot of processes that would have to happen. I'll let, you know, folks like COSA and OSBA speak to the fiscal impacts on districts, but I just wanted to clarify that there is a fiscal impact for the department, but it's not, I've heard people speculate the high hundreds of thousands and millions, and that's certainly not the case for the agency. But it is, there is new work that would be created by changing the diploma standards.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan, tell us again, which are the assessments that are current, the essential skills that are being currently assessed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, the ones that are being assessed, I believe, are reading, writing, math, which the board has proposed delaying for 2 years, and I believe public speaking, but I need to double check on that.
And the social sciences skills aren't currently under assessment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, if it's okay, I've got some backup in the audience, and if I can invite Andy Morgan, the other ODE Morgan, up to the dais to maybe help me out here, because she might know some of this stuff a little better than I do. If that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I'm Andrea Morgan, Social Sciences Specialist for ODE. And currently, the social science assessment is developed, and it's fully developed just as it is for mathematics or science or English language arts. However, it's an optional assessment. So districts have the option of giving the assessment to their students. At this point, very few of our districts use the assessment. It's there, it's available, it's ready, it includes things on all of our standards, including personal finance, which is part of economics. But very few districts use the assessment because they're spending their time in their computer labs doing the reading tests, the math tests, and others.
Okay. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Senator Metzger's interest, and I think the whole committee's interest in how do we how do we hang on to this thing in a way that keeps it alive and advances? And I'm wondering if the best practice for achieving results, what I heard was embedding it in existing curriculum. And if we were to look at this on a phased approach, rather than a top-down but a bottom-up, where we were asking subject matter experts, for example, math, to embed in their instructional methods personal finance, so that it's just one of the tools that they use. Is that a way of advancing this in a way that doesn't have a huge fiscal impact and keeps it alive and maybe in an appropriate way put it in the statute and then eventually phase it on out to where we are measuring it as an essential skill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think the most honest answer to your question about the fiscal is that the primary fiscal cost would not be borne by the department. It would be borne by the school districts, depending on how you did it. So I think there's probably ways in the bill that we could, you know, move some dates around, perhaps talk to our assessment people, see what's available to sort of do your phase-in approach idea on tests and things like that that could potentially drive the fiscal down for the agency, but there's still going to be a fiscal for the agency, and I'm not equipped to sort of say what the capacity is for school districts to phase that in. You know, I know that other folks are going to be speaking on that, and they might be better equipped to answer that question on what they could do at the local level.
Just as far as it seems to me, if I'm a math instructor, the state is not telling me how to teach my class. I mean, obviously they have to have success and mastery. But if we somehow wrote something that encouraged that math instructor to embed, to the extent possible, personal finance in the subject matter, how do we go about doing that in a way that doesn't create a huge fiscal, but yet advances this thing and achieves the results we intend, which is to have students that understand how to manage money and live in this complex world.
Right. Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I think maybe if you can give us an opportunity, we could attempt to answer that question for you. But
Senator Morris.
I mean, sorry.
We're the Bobbsey twins from now on.
I did the same thing. I don't know what it is with you two.
Mr. Chair, it just seems like there's got to be some way keep this thing moving in a rational,
I agree.
This, thoughtful way.
You know, the legislature asked this task force be created, and they met not 8 times as requested, but 13 times, and did a lot of research. And I know Rick, Senator Metzger, and the credit unions did a lot of research too. Mr. Allen's right that, you know, we are trying to like preserve math here. This. Biennium, and it would be a shame to see all that work slide out the window. Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the embedding, you know, if we're having trouble, we go to a small school and we're having trouble finding a teacher who can teach this as a class, I think I'm curious as to what sort of additional training would be required if we're going to embed this throughout the entire curriculum. I go back to the Dash 1 amendment here, and I would suggest if you're needing to recreate standards, you go back to the ones that we abandon as a good starting place. But, you know, when I went to school, this was taken up in senior year of high school. It was a requirement. And so that may not be the whole answer, but certainly it's better than what we've got now. And, you know, we had a class called Modern Problems senior year. You did finance, you did economics, you did civics, you did all those things. And it was a pretty comprehensive class. All seniors took it. You had to take it to graduate. And we have lost that piece of it, and so at least with this, I think it's moving us to at least making sure at this point in time that we're moving towards something for financial literacy as opposed to nothing. And I'm just, you know, the embedding in the entire curriculum, I think, is a more comprehensive, probably longer-term goal, but I guess I kind of see this as at least moving in the right direction for the short term.
Chair House, Senator Cruz, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that we really do still have personal finance standards. And when you heard from Pam as she was quoting the survey, we're among those states that have standards and require instruction to our standards. We're part of the good guys in all of that. We don't have a required assessment of those standards, however.
Right.
The other part is districts are required to provide instruction to the standards. And what we've heard is that maybe we should be going and, you know, taking a hard look at Corvallis School District as the one that was mentioned, that they're not in compliance because they're not teaching to the standards. But I think if you went in and you looked, they probably have places that they are teaching those standards, not in a personal finance class any longer. However, they are teaching it maybe along with their history course or in their regular economics course. But what we find, I guess the bottom line that the task force found, and as I staff that task force, one of the things that becomes very clear is that you can't teach financial literacy just in a half unit at high school. It has to begin at elementary. And we're more likely to be able to develop materials and use our partners from the Credit Union Association and other groups to come in and help with that curriculum in our districts if we are embedding it along the way and doing those pieces. When it gets tough is when you've got a teacher that has a group of 35 kids in a classroom and is expected to teach for a half year an intense personal finance course. But if it can be broke up, it can probably be done better, and it can be included in those standards and the expectations for instruction.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there may be others in this in the room who could answer this as well, but do you happen to know if the some of the personal or professional development, excuse me, for teachers includes this type of personal finance? For example, now would a math teacher be taking some professional development that includes personal finance as part of the problem solving and the math problems that students need to learn these days?
Chair Haas and Senator Bonamici, there are some professional development opportunities, but not many in the social sciences in this area in personal finance. Teacher training is expensive, and summer programs, you're probably well aware, in some of the other content areas, it's expensive, and to come up with summer time for this. Personal finance is not an area where teachers have to be highly qualified. You have to be a social studies teacher, and if you look at things like the praxis, which teachers take as part of their or to become a certified teacher, there's no questions about personal finance in the praxis. It's an outside area. And so in that way, you know, when we talk about highly qualified and getting more professional development, certainly there are some things, but we're not seeing, like, you know, hundreds of math teachers being trained or even hundreds of social studies teachers being trained. This is a smaller area in terms of interest, and most of them are looking at what the federal government sees as a core content area, which are the areas of history, geography, economics, and civics. And so you'll see most of your professional development in those areas.
Just a point. Thank you for your testimony. Because one thing that Susan pointed out, when you talk about the examples of Corvallis or wherever, and one thing the task force found, and as she reiterated, that if it isn't assessed, it isn't taught. I mean, that was the point. And when they had those teachers there, that there was quite a dichotomy of where that was. But one thing I just kind of want to establish for the record, we're talking about, well, it's good to have standards and things in the earlier grades, which is absolutely true, but I don't want people to get confused that by having a graduation requirement, i.e. having it tested, changes in any way the K through 8 standards for for this. So this isn't a replacement for it. So that status quo, if that's good or if it's evolving, continues to be part of the standards for the other grades. This is an add-on to where we currently are. And but somehow, I think in some of the dialogue, it almost sounded like it was an either-or. If we do this, and all of a sudden we don't have standards for K through 8, and those would don't change under this legislation. It's just trying to take a step farther than what we currently have.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, and that, you know, I think what you're describing is sort of what, you know, would drive some of the costs for us to redo that. You know, making sure that there's those assessments in place to test these new requirements, and making sure that the standards, make sure that the kids are being instructed in the standards that they would be tested on.
Okay, thank you both. Appreciate you coming up here, being asked to come at the last minute. I have Robert Wilkers signed up to testify.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee. I think I have a statement here that was prepared before I heard today's debate, so it's going to be kind of redundant. But I think there are a few points I'd like to add to the discussion. I'm Bob Wilner, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council, a nonprofit organization concerned with preparing our citizens for their future in a global society. Working toward that goal, I've been increasingly concerned with how our next generation can fulfill their responsibilities at home as well. And this brings us to the social studies, which was basically, I was never a teacher, but I was a practitioner of the social studies for 25 years in the Foreign Service. And I believe strongly in its importance. In the past, I've suggested that if the whole purpose of public education was to prepare employees for the workplace, then logically the employers would have to pay for it. And that did not seem well accepted, but I think the point is not to implement the premise, but to identify it as fallacious, that the purpose of public education, I believe, is to prepare public citizens to run a democracy. There's a very broad set of requirements. And this means, I think, that the social sciences are a survival skill. With that in mind, I hate to see them further restricted. I hate to see a zero-sum game here where if we're going to get into financial literacy, something has to come out of the social studies. And I find myself wondering, why couldn't we add, if we're going to call it a social science, which is dubious, why don't we add to the social sciences to put them at an equal level with English and math? Because I think they're crucially important in the survival of our society. As our world becomes more crowded, I think it just becomes more essential that our young people learn about it. So I would suggest adding, if financial literacy is that an important issue, I suggest we add it to the other social sciences rather than replace something. There's also been a discussion of teaching preparation, and that is a significant item. I've heard from teachers, I've not been a teacher myself, but I know a good many of them who've said that in their schools, financial literacy was generally not well taught. And obviously, there's a lot of need for improvement in the teaching methods for financial literacy. And I guess I would have to ask if a particular section of our economy places such a high import on this kind of teaching, maybe we should ask the organizations that are proposing this as a standard to pony up some for the cost of implementing that standard. It's of general interest, but here's an industry that has a particular interest. And I would ask, what is the responsibility for the lender for determining the financial reliability of the borrower? Is this all up to the public schools, or doesn't the bank or the credit union or the credit card company has some responsibility for checking out its customers, its borrowers, and making sure that they really are safe, and maybe providing some instructions for them if it's needed. So I guess I'm just asking that, come back to my original comment, why do we have to approach this as a zero-sum game? If this is so important, why can't we add it? Because all those other things are crucially important as well. And I would urge that the committee reconsider the either-or approach to financial literacy and see if there isn't a way to implement it. And as has been suggested, over a period of years, not as a single dose, but as something built into the curriculum. As I recall my elementary and high school days, I think we started on bank accounts when I was in second or third grade, and the principal instruction in balancing a check account came in eighth grade in a business skills course. So I would suggest that we maybe have another look at this whole process and consider how to integrate it with the rest of essential educational content rather than an either-or approach. I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Milner. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bills 441 or 511? Senator Metzger?
Just as a concluding comment, Mr. Chair, first of all, I want to thank you for helping to continue to push this issue, and as we evolve this and try and see where we go with this, but it's something that I certainly got my teeth into this thing, and it's I believe that we need to move this forward. I'd also want to just make a comment to the public as a closing note why it's important. You know, we have an entire committee in this legislature, and it's chaired by the person at the end of the dais here on consumer protection affairs, and it's one bill after another to try to close the door on bad actors and problems, most of which have involved from a lack of financial literacy, whether it's the debt collector bills we've been passing, new ideas on mortgage lending for reverse mortgages, auto liability payments, and understanding the financial implications of signing forms, credit scoring being used in loan application. It's one bill after another, and it takes a whole committee to continue to try and have the after effects of a citizenry that isn't as financial literate as possible, and so we try to penalize those who take advantage of the people who haven't got that education. And I think it's very much apparent in our society, and we can do better on it. We can do better. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the dedication of your time and the committee.
Thank you, Senator Metzger.
Thank you. And Senator Metzger, I'd be more than happy to work with you to make sure that someday in the future maybe we won't need that committee anymore. Thank you.
I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 441 and 501. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 348. Sherry Stock, is she? Here she is.
Do you want a quick recap, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the bill that we had before us a little while ago in February regarding traumatic brain injuries and football helmets. We have -5 amendments before us that I believe Ms. Stock will speak to.
Right, and committee, this dramatically narrows the original bill. Ms. Stock?
It does. It takes all reference of helmets out of the bill, and basically what it is it talks about what a concussion is, and the Oregon School Athletics Association is the one that drafted that language and uses it in their training, and it would require all coaches of interscholastic sports to have concussion trainings to be able to understand and identify when a child has sustained a concussion, so we won't have a Natasha Richardson. And the training there's no fiscal impact at all. The training would be done through community resources, hospitals. These trainings are already going on. It would just, more coaches would be participating. And actually, the Oregon Health Science University is creating an online training that will be free, that coaches can participate in, so they don't even have to come in person to a training. They would take it online, and just as long as they get annual training to remind them.
The committee, you'll recall we had testimony from several doctors who said much of the problem with concussions in young athletes is not necessarily just the helmet, but that they go back into the game, or their coaches, we all know with our days of football, was, you know, walk it off and get back in there. And that was part of the tragedy that unfolded at Taft High School some years ago. Any questions, Ms. Stott? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you. I have a question about the way something is worded on the Dash 5 amendment. Would you be the appropriate person to ask that of?
Could be.
Online, it's the paragraph that starts on line 17 of the first page of the Dash 5 amendment, where it says a coach may not allow a member of a school athletic team to participate in any athletic event or training on the same day that the member, and then it has the two different categories, exhibit signs or has been diagnosed. And I'm just wondering about where the day part came in, because what if it's... I'm just trying to figure out where the temporal aspect came from. It seemed that the coach shouldn't allow the member of the team to participate any time.
Yeah, but see, the thought was keep out for 15 minutes and then go back in. Well, we know now Natasha Richardson took an hour before her headache hit and 2 hours before she was brain dead. And so we know that it's not immediate. And so that's what this is addressing, is they should stay out at least a day before they go back in. Many coaches, especially when the game's on the line, they want, and that's what happened to Max, and this is Max's right. Law, is that the coach pulled him out, then sent him back in, and he actually had three concussions, so the secondary concussion impact syndrome set in, and you saw Max's video. And so this is something that is so easy to avoid, and that's all this is. This is a prevention and avoidance mechanism.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonamici.
I think my concern is that a day might not be enough time. And if you could just clarify, is that what the paragraph B is intended to cover?
Yeah, if they suspect when the first hit happens and they don't show any signs of concussion, they're still pulled out for a day. If they show any of the signs of concussion, then they're out for 8 days.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if it's they do have it, then they also have to have a note from a medical professional saying that they're no longer exhibiting signs. And I should stress, too, that the Center for Disease Control has created training packets for coaches. So all these trainings are available for free. And they're already created, so we're not reinventing the wheel. Everything exists. This is a huge problem, and in fact, this year is nationally is a year of sports concussion education from the Brain Injury Association of the National, as well as the Center for Disease Control. We just happen to be the first state to be picking up something exactly like this.
Further questions? Senator Bruce?
Yeah, not so much a question. I think this is an excellent first step, and just kind of for the record, I would encourage the OSAA to consider over time because there are tests that can be given to student athletes at the beginning of the season that would inform the coaches on retesting if they suspect that there's a concussive event has happened that would further help inform that decision. And it is available, and I think hopefully the OSAA will kind of look at rolling that sort of program out to schools over time.
Yeah, that's called the impact test. And there is a fiscal cost to that. We
right.
thought when this was when we were rolling great 2 years ago, that was going to be part of this bill.
Right.
Not now.
But understanding the situation we're in at this point in time, but I think in the future that's something that needs to be considered by the OSAA. So let them figure out how to make it happen.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 348 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 348.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 348.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 348. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 348 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 348 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the proponents for coming back with this proposal. It was a very compelling testimony in the hearing, and I'm glad we were able to do something. My question, and I'm sorry if I missed that, is the State Board of Education going to absorb the rulemaking in their existing budget?
Yes, we have fiscal and revenue statements that show minimal
fiscal impact statements.
Thank you. And I'm also missing the 8 days that you mentioned. Is that something that you're anticipating will be done by rule?
Actually, the OSAA, it is in their list, and it was sometimes things from legislative council don't make it in.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Who would have thought?
Senator Metzger.
I just also want to give kudos to those who worked on this and Senator Morissette for bringing it forward. It was very compelling testimony, and particularly from the medical profession about how easy it is to provide people with the framework to know when it's have the time to have a timeout, and that if we provide that, that we can perhaps prevent some very serious injuries. And, this does that, and it's not intrusive, doesn't take a lot of time, but it could certainly save someone's life. And so I really appreciate the effort that was put into this and from the proponents and Senator Morissette, who brought it forward.
And Mr. Chair, if I can make one more comment. Thank you. I also think that this is going to provide cover, if you will, to coaches who had a lot of pressure, I think, from parents and maybe team members to put somebody back in a game, and now they can say, I can't.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Good point.
Thank you.
Good point. If there is no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morris?
Aye.
Chair Hatch?
Aye. The measure passes, and Senator Morissette can carry this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 348. And finally, and quickly, we have a referral issue here on Senate Bill 695. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 695.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the bill regarding payment for breakfast in schools. It has not changed since the last time the measure was before you, but there is now a fiscal statement that has been issued. It has a subsequent referral, the bill does, to Ways and Means.
And as you all know, we heard lots of testimony on this, and our goal was to determine and listen to the testimony without weighing in the cost. That will all be settled up in Ways and Means. And this is a measure that we will refer to Ways and Means based on discussion interaction here. But that is about the most rambling thing I've said.
Yes.
Is it approved?
But you did it well. Mr. Chair, I've had this discussion in other committees that it's easy for us to say this is a good idea, send it to Ways and Means, and let them wrestle with it. But from the perspective that spending money is a policy decision as well, and I just have a great deal of concern, not disputing the merits, but it is $2.25 million. And with the state of this economy, I'm not sure that this sort of new expenditure is appropriate at this point in time. Like I say, it has nothing to do necessarily with the merit, but that's a lot of money.
don't think anybody would disagree with you on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Cruz that that is a lot of money and these are very difficult times, but I'm supporting this bill. I'm supporting its referral to Ways and Means because I understand that with that expenditure in state funds, we will be bringing not only that much but more back in terms of federal money. And so I understand that's something that needs to be considered, but I see it as a kind of win-win in that regard in that it's going to contribute to the health and success of our students and also bring the federal money in to help. So.
You must have had financial literacy courses in high school. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I will assist you and move that we move this out of committee. But in the context of the environment we're in, absent the federal funding that Senator Bonamici refers to, I could not support adding additional expenditure when we're reducing the basic services. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 695 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 695 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would probably support it if it went without recommendation. But just under these circumstances, I mean, then let it be an unbiased decision in Ways and Means. Just a thought.
Fair enough. Further discussion?
Are you open to amending the motion, Mr. Chair?
I think we could move it with the way it is now, and Senator Cruz is okay with a no?
I would rather be a yes, but but I've been known to be a no before.
No.
What? Really?
I know. It's a shock. I voted yes today, and they recorded me as a no. I couldn't believe it. So.
They didn't think you had a yes.
They just predicted it in advance. That's
they just know which button is usually pushed.
Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Cruz? Very reluctant, no.
Senator
Metzger?
Aye.
Which does send a message.
Aye.
In a way.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. And that does it for today, except for this announcement. We will meet on Friday.
Yay.
But I use the word we in a parentheses. I have a Northwest Health Foundation board meeting. That I have to present on Friday, and Senator Morris has kindly agreed to chair that meeting, and I'll be available by cell phone.
So we can do all those bills you won't let
yeah,
us do?
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to put up all those
you can finally send the sales tax bill down. The we are adjourned.
We can get that.